This is Harv Aronson of the Total Sports Recall Podcast, and when I start my workday, it always begins with that morning shower. Normally, I use a liquid body wash, but recently I purchased a bar of Sterling Soap Company's handcrafted bath soap and decided to give their Deep Blue Sea handcrafted bath soap a try. Immediately, the aroma of Sterling's bath soap was obvious, and in using this soap, I felt refreshed, clean, energized, and Sterling's bath soap helped me step out of that shower with the momentum and eagerness to get my day rolling. If you want to get a refreshing wake-up call in the morning and get your busy day off to the right start, I highly recommend going to Sterling Soap Company's website and order one of their many varieties of bath soaps among other products they offer. Visit Sterling Soap Company at sterlingsoap.com. That's S-T-I-R-L-I-N-G soap.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Statman and Robin podcast. We are the dynamic duo of Baltimore sports history. I am Jim Johnson, the Statman, along with my partner, Robin Haynes. Rob, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Doing great, Jim. This is podcast number two for us. Hey. And our previous podcast, our introductory podcast, I promised something in that podcast, and then I didn't deliver on it. So I'm going to try to make that up. My apologies to our dedicated followers. Can we have dedicated followers on our
Let's say we do.
Second podcast, we'll just pretend that we do.
Yeah.
So, our first podcast, I did mention my first name, Robin, and I was going to kind of talk about that a little bit and then never got to it. So I am named after Baseball Hall of Famer Robin Roberts. And if you want to know the story, my dad.
We do.
Way back when, way before I was born, when he was a teenager, he grew up in the Baltimore area. And of course, he followed the minor league Orioles, listened to them on the radio. But as he got into his teen years, he started following the next closest team, I guess you would say, to Baltimore would be Philadelphia. In 1950, those were the Whiz Kids. And Robin Roberts, that was the first time he won 20 games, and the Phillies managed to win the National League pennant that year. And he, around that time, was telling his buddies, you know, if I ever have a son, I'm going to name him Robin, after Robin Roberts. So that's how that came to be. Now, Baltimore sports connection, Robin Roberts. Everybody thinks of him pitching for the Phillies, and he was incredible in the 50s. Just look it up. The number of times he won 20 games, the innings pitched, the starts, complete games. It's kind of amazing when you look at it compared to today's game for him and a lot of pitchers back then. But anyway, he ended up on the Orioles at kind of the tail end of his career, but he still had a lot left in the tank. Pitched for the Orioles from 62 into 1965. He pitched really well. He was, as the Orioles had some young starters coming up, established starters, he was a mentor to a lot of them. And I do vaguely remember hearing my grandfather say something when I was a kid, when I was just barely old enough to remember, saying something about Robin Roberts being on the Orioles. And I'm sure, you know, somebody probably mentioned it to me like, oh, that's the guy you're named after. I don't really remember that and making much of a connection at the time. But anyway, that's the connection. I've also, there have been a couple times, you know, maybe I've been like in a sports bar and you start talking to some guys around you about baseball or whatever. Maybe you kind of introduce yourself. And there have been a couple times when I say, you know, my name is Robin, and I might mention, you know, I'm named after a Baseball Hall of Famer. And sometimes people think, oh, gosh, you're named after Robin Yount. So if I were only young enough to be named after
Robin. There you go. Yeah.
You could subtract about 20 years, I guess, from my current age.
He's probably around our age, isn't he?
I believe so. I want to
Yeah.
say he
He's a
was one
little
of
old.
those phenoms who started playing every day for the Brewers when he was 18.
Yeah.
And I want to say that was around 74. Sounds about
Yeah.
right.
Yeah,
Yeah.
so probably a little bit
So
older.
anyway.
Close enough. Yeah. Not to where you would have been named after him, that's for sure.
Exactly. So anyway, there's that connection. I'm sure everybody, if you listen to the first podcast, you're dying to find out about
There you go.
that.
So thanks for clearing that. By the way, you told you said, hey, you could look it up. So I looked it up, stat man, that's what I'm supposed to do, right? And
Exactly.
just a couple of the amazing stats for Robin Roberts, particularly 1950 through 1955, were his halcyon days, as they say. And he pitched over 300 innings every year.
Wow.
And he had five, well, he had 30 complete games in 52, then 33, then 29. And in 1952, he won 28 games
28 games.
for a team that did not win the pennant. I don't know how well they did that year. Probably fairly well. And he was second in the MVP voting. Just to hear that. Yeah, he never had much exposure to the postseason, did he? Just that one start he made in the 1950 World Series.
Yeah, and he just missed out with the Orioles. He did
Yeah.
pitch for the Orioles into 1965, and of course, the following year, the Orioles won it all. I do remember my dad telling me that around that time, prior to '66, the Orioles were saying that they wanted to use him more out of the bullpen, not just strictly as a bullpen guy.
Right.
And he actually, I think he had a little bit too much pride. And he kind of made it known to the Orioles. I don't think he really wanted to hang around. So if you can find another team for me, and that's what ended up happening. But yeah, he could have gotten a World Series ring if he had just hung on for
Yeah.
another year with the Orioles.
Well, his last full season with the Orioles, he went 13-7 with a 2.91 ERA during his 37-year-old season.
Yeah, no, he still had it. And he
He
pitched
really did.
well into
Yeah.
the late 60s.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for clearing up that mystery. Yes.
Jim, I wanted to kind of throw things back to you because I know that you have something that you want to share in terms of how we got hooked.
Oh yeah, that's this theory, or the theme of our podcast this week. Hooked in a good way, most of the time. Most of the time. Going back into our youth, we both had specific games that just grabbed us, just caught us. And mine is going to sound like a really odd game to capture you, as I've tried to explain this to my wife, who's showed a reasonable amount of interest in that, because you hear the numbers and the numbers sound, how can that possibly be interesting? But the backstory was cool. So my game is January 9th, 1971. University of Maryland basketball, men's basketball team, was playing the number two team in the nation, South Carolina. And this was South Carolina's last year in the ACC. Their football coach took them out of the ACC because he thought the academic requirements were too stringent. That really does sound like it's a universe ago, and in college sports, it was. And this game was played with much different rules than are in place now. Obviously, well before the shot clock, well before the three-point shot. That three-point shot was still considered an ABA gimmick, along with the red, white, and blue ball. But another key rule that I believe came in as a largely as a result of this game was the 5-second closely guarded rule. And you remember that, Rob. It's you if a defender closely guarded you for 5 seconds, you had to give up the ball or else it was a jump ball. That rule was not in existence in this game, and Maryland took full advantage of it. Now, there was a lot of bad blood going into this game. Now, South Carolina was ranked number two in the nation. They had an All-American player, John Roach, who had a fair to middling ABA career after this, but he was one of the best players in the nation. Not named, I guess that was, I forget who got the player of the year, because that was between Alcindor and Walton, so I'm not sure who got it that year. But he was one of the All-Americans. And they had already played a game in December down in South Carolina, and as you would expect, the number two team of the nation pounded a still pretty mediocre Maryland team, 96-70, and Roche had 38 points. However, that didn't stop hostilities from breaking out, literally, and there was a brawl which spilled into the stands in South Carolina, and a nondescript Gamecock player named John Rybak popped Maryland coach Lefty Gisell right in the mouth.
Yep.
And later, South Carolina's coach, Frank McGuire, claimed that nobody hit Lefty. He punched himself in the mouth to become a victim. Now, I don't think either one of us would have put that past Lefty, but I believe there was some film. The game was not televised, as few games were then, so there wasn't a lot of evidence. But the bad blood was so much, the ACC actually seriously considered canceling that the rematch in Maryland because they were afraid of, you know, things happening again, a round two. Right. And the Diamondback student newspaper, the Friday before the game, it was a Saturday night game. That Friday, they took out a full page saying, please, please, everybody, be cool. We don't want any trouble. Lefty, this was Lefty's second year at Maryland. And he was still looking for that scalp, that big win. Well, scalp, that's unintentional pun because of Lefty. But he was looking for that first big win. And he didn't want anything to mess this game up. So he took the microphone before the game started and told the students, I'm paraphrasing here, you want to be champions? Well, we need to act like champions tonight. And they did. There wasn't any problem with the students. Now, we had issues many years later, but the students that night were fantastic because what happened at the start of the game is, and you know, Maryland was a mediocre team. They wound up 14-12 that year, okay? I think they were 8-3 going into the game. So they came out wanting a slow tempo, and this was – a practice of the times. Remember the stall game, okay? If you're shorten the game was the coaching phrase of it. Take the ball out of play as much as possible and try to hit the few shots you do take.
Right.
And so South Carolina came out playing a zone defense. And Maryland said, the Lefty told the players, don't attack. Make them come out and play man-to-man. Again, a standard strategy of the time. Frank McGuire, South Carolina's coach, said no. And they just kind of stayed back and watched Maryland pass the ball back and pass the ball back. And there's one picture that made one of the newspapers of the Maryland point guard, Howard White, standing there with the ball on his hip.
On his hip, yep.
Yeah, just standing there. But the fascinating thing is, and the game was locally televised, which was very unusual at the time, on Channel 7 in D.C., which, you know, most of Baltimore was able to pick up, fortunately. And interestingly, one of the broadcasters, the analyst of that game, was Sonny Jurgensen, who was still the Redskins quarterback, but he was also a big basketball guy and a pretty decent analyst. He did Bullets games later on. I couldn't find out or remember who the play-by-play guy was. Probably one of Channel 7's sportcasters. So, but anyway, they came out and there was almost no action in the first half. But the Terps crowd got into it. They're like, yeah. And they were cheering, they were chanting. And for a game that literally nothing was happening, it was very exciting. And the first half ended with Howard White hitting a jump shot to give Maryland a 4-3 lead.
Yeah, I remember that score going into halftime. Isn't that crazy?
Right. How can you forget it? Yeah. Now, the little personal story I'll tell about it is I did not see that first half because I was just kind of getting up to speed on Maryland sports. And, you know, the basketball team at that point really hadn't done anything except recruit Tom McMillan.
Right.
McMillan had made the cover of Sports Illustrated as a high school kid. Lefty stole him from Dean Smith. Yes. And they were playing, he was playing on the freshman team with somebody nobody had ever heard of named Len Elmore. And they were winning by 30 points a game. They still had a freshman team. That was the last year. Told you it was a different game. For our listeners, and what freshmen? Well, freshmen were a year away from being eligible.
Right.
So Elmore and McMillan and I don't know, probably volunteers, ran roughshod over the other freshman team, and they had an average margin of over 30 points a game and undefeated. And in some games, they had a bigger crowd for the freshman game, and then some of the fans would leave. Go, okay, we saw what we needed to see, right?
And I remember Tom McMillan making the cover of Sports Illustrated, I think shortly after Lefty had gotten a commitment from him to come to Maryland.
Yeah.
And that was such a big deal as far as putting Maryland basketball locally in everybody's consciousness. I mean, as a kid, you know, everybody's talking about that, bringing that Sports Illustrated magazine to school and guys looking at it. And yeah, people really started to talk about Maryland basketball. Again, the team wasn't that great that year, but again, continue into the second half of that legendary game.
Right. And they were scrappy, and they had a couple of decent players, Howard White and Jim O'Brien, who had the unfortunate nickname of Bozo because he had this big mop of red curly hair, and it kind of fit, and he dealt with it. You know, he was a local guy from Northern Virginia. So so anyway, the second half started, and the pace didn't really pick up. And actually, Channel 7 had gotten viewers calling in during the first half complaining about how boring the game was.
Oh, really? I've never heard that.
Yeah. They're like, well, what are they supposed to do about it? You know, they got the Washington papers after the game. It's like, what are they supposed to do? Hey, come on, pick up the pace. I mean, you know. So, but my dad had come in at halftime. He was out. He was doing stuff in his garage. And he said, hey, I heard Maryland's winning 4-3. I'm like, oh, that can't be right. You know, right? A 12-year-old, you know, he always knows more than his dad, right?
Right.
So, I'll turn on, find out what the score really is. I'm like, well, I'll be, it's 4-3. What is going on here? So I sat down. I was interested in my black and white TV in the living room. We hadn't upgraded yet. And the second half played out with a little more action, but still Maryland was not aggressively attacking. And we wound up late in the game, and I want to make sure I got my numbers right here, with South Carolina holding on to a 23-21 lead. Told you, it didn't pick up a whole lot, but it did pick up some. And another rule in effect, it just really struck me what a different game it was. They still had the rule in effect, a common foul, non-shooting foul, before you reach the foul limit, had one free throw. That rule was still in effect in college and the pros. I think it went into effect in the 72-73 season where you had the ball out of bounds. So Maryland held for the last shot, down two, and then they fouled Howard White. And he only had the one free throw. So, yeah, they weren't doing a lot of fouling because there wasn't a lot of action.
Right. Okay?
So White missed the shot. I believe it missed it intentionally. Jim O'Brien got the rebound and got the putback with about 4 seconds left and went into overtime, tied at 23. And, of course, the crowd was just going berserk.
Right.
But then South Carolina came out and controlled the overtime. So with 24 seconds left, they were up 30-25. Then it got crazy. O'Brien hit a shot with 10 seconds to go, 30-27. Okay, we're keeping it close. Lefty called a timeout.
And remember, no three-point shot back then. 30-27.
That's a
looking
that's
good.
Very good reminder. Yeah, you needed two more possessions, two possession game, as they would say then, or as they would say now. They didn't say that kind of thing then. So John Roche, the All-American, was inbounding it, and the pass got intercepted by Howard White. He fed some guy named Dick Stallball. His one moment claim to fame is he hit a layup to make it 30-29.
Right.
The crowd was bonkers.
Going nuts.
So no timeout. Roche inbounded the ball again. Jim O'Brien intercepted it. hit a shot with 2 seconds left, and the place was so loud nobody heard Frank McGuire trying to call timeout. That was it, and the crowd stormed the court, which I am positive had to be the first time that had ever happened in Kohl Fieldhouse.
No
because
doubt.
There wasn't any particular reason to.
Exactly.
The program had been either mediocre or bad for a long time.
Right.
And one of the things Lefty did is he had added the temporary seats inside the fixed seats, because I think the fixed capacity was 12,400, something like that. And they were way away from the court. And that was one of the first things he saw. He looked at it and said, we got to fill this thing up. So they had 14,200 and some for that game. It was a sellout. And they squeezed a few more in for the finale against Virginia, and then it later became 14-5. But that was the first big-time game and big-time crowd at Kohl Fieldhouse, and I was hooked.
Right.
That was just so incredibly exciting. I wanted to be a part of it. And then, of course, the next few years with Elmore McMillan and John Lucas, they were pretty exciting. So I picked a good time. So.
Yeah, and one other thing I remember about that game, like you said, it was televised locally.
Yeah.
And I remember going back into school the following Monday.
Oh, that's right.
And
yeah.
all the kids are talking yeah. about watching that game and how into it they were. And even the girls, some of the girls were talking about how they were watching it and just going nuts. And again, that's another thing that's going to get you hooked as a kid. When Even not the diehard sports fans in your peer group, but just kind of like all the kids are talking about it.
Yeah, that game, that made Maryland cool. That
yeah.
game made Maryland cool. And they stayed cool for a long, long time.
Right.
So, okay, now, Rob, it's your turn. What was the game that got you hooked on a particular team?
Yeah, I want to talk about a game that might not be in the consciousness too much of Baltimore sports fans from back in the day. But everybody knows about Super Bowl III, the Jets' humongous upset over the Baltimore Colts.
Your dad still hasn't gotten over that, has he?
Still has not gotten over it. and of course, that's, you know, if the NFL's around for 500 years, that'll still be a legendary game.
Oh, yeah.
But the game that got the Colts into that Super Bowl, which was really the NFL championship game for the 1968 season, December 29th of 68, the Colts, Baltimore Colts, defeated the Cleveland Browns 34-0. So that season, again, people wonder why it was such a big upset in Super Bowl III. Well, for one thing, the Colts were 15-1 that season. Well, they were 15-1 when you include postseason games, but they only lost one regular season game, and it was to the Browns. But the Colts were 6-point favorites going into that game, and it was played in Cleveland. Now, you lose one regular season game. I'm hoping you, Statman, might have a recollection of why that game would have been played in Cleveland when the Browns had lost 5 regular season games and the Colts had only lost 1.
I can help you out with that. It was strictly a rotation.
Okay.
The 67 championship had been played in Green Bay, the Western team, and then 68. 66 championship was in Dallas, the Eastern team. Yeah, so they rotated.
Okay, I had totally forgotten about that.
Yeah.
Wow. So anyway, game was played in Cleveland. And I remember watching that game. And I think one thing that helps football in terms of getting into your memory that you'll never forget is, well, back then, pro football was only played on Sunday. So you're more likely to have friends and family gathered around the TV and you're watching the game together. Football has that advantage because, you know, there are a lot of great baseball games that It might have been played on a weeknight, and maybe you didn't have that gathering, around the TV.
That's a
But
really good point.
anyway, that really got my attention, because nobody expected the Colts to just destroy the Browns like that. And if you want to kind of wonder why were the Colts such heavy favorites going into Super Bowl III, that game played a big role.
Sure.
I mean, everybody, the Colts were the consensus best team, even if they didn't shut out the Browns. But again, I remember that game really well, and it really got my attention. Like, I really knew the Colts were good. I kind of remember, oh yeah, they've only lost one game, but yeah, to go into Cleveland and just destroy the Browns like that. Now, a couple weeks later, the memories aren't so good, but anyway, that game played a big part in getting me hooked.
Well, and that was the year of the super sub quarterback for the Colts.
Yes, Earl Morrall, who I think he threw for like 150, 160 yards that day. But
Didn't
again,
have to. Yeah.
you didn't have to, right.
Now, if I remember correctly, the Sports Illustrated cover the next week was Tom Matte going into the end zone.
Yes.
I'm not from memory for some reason.
Tom Matte, I think, scored three touchdowns that day. I think the final one. There were a lot of Cleveland fans. I remember Tom Matte talking about this years later. There were a lot of Cleveland fans that were giving him a bunch of crap because he was actually a local kid.
That's
He was
right.
from Ohio.
Yeah, went to Ohio State, right?
Yes. And when he scored his third touchdown, I just remember Tom Matte saying at that point in the game, he had had enough hearing from some of the fans, and he really gave it right back to him.
Yeah, can't blame him. Yeah, game was in hand. Why not?
Right.
Let it rip. And that defense that year, Rob, that was one of the great defenses in NFL history, wasn't it?
Yeah, it really was. I mean, even in Super Bowl III, it's not like the Jets just moved up and down the field on the Colts.
Not at all.
Just the Colts. It was mostly the Colts offense doing the wrong thing at the worst possible time, for the most part, is kind of what lost in that game.
Do you still have that image in your head of Jimmy Orr waving his hands and running in the end zone wide open and Morrall not seeing him?
Yeah, and that was right before the end of the first half, which, a touchdown right there makes it a totally different game.
Because the Jets were just able to grind it, and
Yes.
let's not talk much about that. That'd be the game that could get you unhooked, but but probably did that game probably did get a lot of other people hooked
There's no
because of
doubt in
the
terms there's no doubt in terms of the NFL moving forward. With the merger, the AFL, the conventional wisdom was the AFL, that's kind of like a second place league, a runner-up league to the NFL. But
Not so much. They got a lot of good players over there. And also that game got Joe Namath in the Hall of Fame.
oh, there's no doubt. There's no doubt. I mean, he had a good career, but yeah. I mean,
Unfortunately, the injuries really, took away from his career, but
right.
it did take away from his career. He had, and that game was won by, excuse me, maybe good play call, but he didn't throw a touchdown pass.
Right.
So and you know, but and I got a lot of respect for him in that because he stayed within the game plan. He didn't try to win it. With all the braggadocio he had by the pool guaranteeing the win, and he let his team win the game. And
Yep.
he kind of steered the bus. But that, yeah, I remember watching that NFL championship game, and man, that was a beatdown. And of course, the fact that Cleveland had beaten the Colts earlier in the season, thinking, well, they got them at home again, or Was that regular season was in Baltimore, wasn't it?
Yes,
Yeah,
yes.
so yeah, now we get him at home. We beat him in Baltimore,
Right.
Back when Memorial Stadium was still known as the largest outdoor insane asylum, in a good way.
was.
Right. Well, that's a good memory, and I know we veered off a little bit, but yeah, that was definitely a good memory. It's just the so I hope listeners can relate to what we're talking about here, and you probably have that game that really you go maybe not necessarily your first game, but
Right.
that game that just got you hooked. And we've been happy to share ours. And if you have that or any other thoughts about the podcast, please email us. That's another thing we forgot to do last week. How do you, or last time, how we can, you can reach us. Statman and Robin, just like the title of the show, at gmail.com. Kept it nice and simple. Statman and
Sure.
Robin at gmail.com. We'd love to hear from our, as Robin pointed out, dedicated listeners. Or even if you're not so dedicated and you're on the fence, we'll get you there.
Well, Statman,
Yes.
speaking of stats, I think you might have an odd little statistical nugget for us.
I got him. I got him. We're gonna be closing our most of our programs with something from the obscure Baltimore sports factoid file, and I'll also take suggestions for a better name for that, but that's just kind of what I came up with.
Oh, what a mouthful.
And we're gonna it is, isn't it? But Rob, I'm gonna put most of these as a question to you that I don't necessarily expect you to answer because I didn't know. Okay, so I'll put that out. Oh, well, I knew that. No, I didn't. Okay. In
And I
the
promise I'm not going to look at my phone on this one, okay?
well, that's fine. In the 1970s, a Baltimore school won a national men's basketball championship with a star that went on to an NBA career, including one appearance in the NBA Finals. Do you have any
Ooh.
idea which school that would be?
In the
If you hear
70s.
the 70s, yeah. If you
Okay.
do, you're a better man than I am.
And it was a Baltimore school.
Baltimore City, yeah.
Ooh. Wow. I'm going to say the school had to be Morgan State. Am I?
Ding, 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 ding. Yes. Now, I did give you a good clue, but still, that's good. Yes, it was Morgan State. In 1974, they won the Division II national championship in lovely Evansville, Indiana. They beat Southwest Missouri 67-52. Now, do you have any idea who the star of that team was, Mr. Hotshot?
Well, the guy that I can remember the best having an incredible career at Morgan was Marvin Webster.
Ding, 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 ding. Yes, sir. Marvin Webster, the human eraser.
Human eraser, that's right.
And he came by that title very naturally. His senior year, get a load of these numbers: 21 points a game, 22 rebounds a game, and 8 blocked shots a game.
8 block shots per
Eight
game.
block shots. That's the
Well,
eraser part of it. That was amazing.
he earned that nickname.
Yes, he really did. And he appeared in the 78 finals against the Bullets. He was Seattle's starting center and had his best year. I think he went about 15 and 10 that year.
That's right. I forgot he played for Seattle.
Yeah, and that was really the only year he was a key player. And he was still pretty young. I think he was like in his third year. Because he played another year at Morgan State. What happened to Marvin, though, is he made a bad career choice after that. He left as a free agent to go to the New York Knicks, and his numbers just went downhill from there. Because that's kind of where the Knicks were at that point in time. And about the time they started getting competitive again, easy for you to say, with Bernard King, he was wrapping up. I think he had knee injuries, and back then, knee injuries pretty well did you in. So he did not have a great career, but he certainly had a great year and came within one game of being an NBA champion. So that is this week's obscure Baltimore factoid. Now I found another one. Why? And I keep saying week. We're doing this a bi-weekly show. Okay. So this is, we don't want to mess up expectations here. But I found another factoid that I'm going to bring up next time,
Okay.
which is another Baltimore, Baltimore-ish area. Not Bal this is not Baltimore City, but Baltimore-ish small college that had their moment in the limelight and their star, who unfortunately didn't fare as well as Webster. So that's all the material we have for you. Any closing comments there, dynamic duo partner?
We're just loving the way this podcast is going. I hope anyone that's been following us is enjoying it. Lots more to come. Just want to remind anyone that is following this Baltimore-based podcast that we are going to cover some of the lesser-known teams and lesser-known sports connected with Baltimore sports history. But we're going to probably front-load things with the teams that people are going to remember the most. But a
Right.
lot of different directions we want to go with this.
It's amazing, and I looked this up a little while back. It's amazing how many what we would call obscure teams had a moment in Baltimore. Just about every sport you can really think of, and a couple that you probably wouldn't think of. Let's say
Right.
team tennis. One example that you really, it's not really going to come to mind. So, yeah, we're going to touch on all those because, and especially in the 70s, 80s, there was a lot of crazy stuff going on in sports.
Sure
And
was.
the 70s were fertile ground for, sports and leagues briefly, in most cases, having a moment in the sun and briefly gathering our attention. So we want to get those snapshots.
Yeah, it seemed like leagues and franchises were just popping up
They
everywhere
really were.
in a lot of different sports.
They really were. Well, thanks, Robin. As he said, we hope you've enjoyed this episode of Statman and Robin. And if you have any questions, ideas, or feedback, email us at statmanandrobin@gmail.com. Remember, it's good to look back as long as you live forward. Thanks for joining us, everyone.
Bye now.
Hey there, sports history fan. This is Arnie Chapman, aka the Football History Dude, and I hope that you enjoyed this recent episode presented by the Sports History Network and were able to learn some good old-fashioned sports history knowledge nuggets. I started the Sports History Network back in 2020 with the mission to help podcasters find a community of like-minded sports history nerds, as well as helping aspiring podcasters to start their own shows. We have a little bit over 30 shows on the network right now covering all sorts of sports history. But as far as I'm concerned, we're just at the toothpick in the ocean moment, you know that. Can't even figure it out because there's so much more coming. We wanted to create the ultimate headquarters for sports yesteryear, starting with Podcast Network and our website, but we're going to continue to move into other mediums as well. And here's the cool part, because we want you to be part of our team. So if you're interested in starting your own podcast, or maybe being a guest on one of our shows, or who knows, maybe even writing an article for us over on the website. Seriously, all you gotta do is reach out to us on the contact page over at sportshistorynetwork.com. You can be as technologically savvy as a Neanderthal tapping on a stone trying to figure out this whole hieroglyphics thing back in the day. Again, it doesn't matter, because even if you don't understand the whole podcast space, we have a production team that can pretty much help you out with doing everything. All you gotta do, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com, head to the contact page, fill it out. That message goes right to me, and I'll reach out to you as soon as I can. But for now, dude, I'm through if you're through.